Blog Talk Radio.
All right, so just phone? Is it on the phone?
Yep, just phone, yep.
Okay, nice. And let me get this, and I'm going to walk outside, sitting because it's nice weather here in Cali. Where are you located? You're on East Coast, right?
Yeah, Asbury Park, New Jersey, the home of Bam Bam Bigelow, if you remember Bam Bam Bigelow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. How is he doing?
Oh, he died many years ago. He actually, I think about 5 years ago.
Yeah, you heard about that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. What was it? What was the reason?
He stopped taking his diabetes medicine. So I think he kind of, I don't know if it was like accidental, but he wasn't taking care of himself and he was overweight and, you know, he basically wasn't taking care of himself and kind of fell apart.
Oh, man, that sucks.
Yeah.
Yep, that happens. Some people suddenly they just feel like they don't need to do it anymore, and then that's where it goes wrong.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I am. All right. So, that's whenever you want to begin.
Okay, cool. So I just do like a little intro for you, and then we just get rolling.
Sounds good.
All right. Joining us on the line right now is the former King of Pancrase, a former UFC Hall of Famer, the former UFC World Heavyweight Champion, an absolute MMA icon, El Guapo himself, Boss Rutten. Boss, welcome to the two-man power trip.
Boom. Yeah, power trips. I love it.
So what in the world have you been up to? I mean, you've been obviously all over the world doing so many different things. What have you been up to lately? And, I mean, probably not much, right?
Yeah, that's the thing, right, with the whole COVID-19 thing. Now I'm streaming, actually, workouts for my gym. Every morning at 10 o'clock, I do it with one person, so it's still it's illegal to do. The gym is closed, of course. But then every morning at 10 a.m. Pacific, you know, to my YouTube, my Facebook page, and to Fight TV. They heard I was doing it, and they asked me if they could also broadcast it out to their 2.5 million members. I say, sure, I would love that. So, yeah, that's keeping us busy. And for the rest, you know, do the things like making cameos, you know, that app.
Yeah.
So they had this new deal today. I made this commercial for that everything today, tomorrow, and the day after, all the proceeds that I make are going to go to COVID-19 and some funds that I help. No Kid Hungry, I believe it's called. And just busy with those kind of things. That's about it.
How's the popularity of the workout? I mean, a lot of people into it since they're all kind of home and looking for something to do.
Yeah, it looks like it is. Yeah, I think, I think a couple of hundred, like we have like a guy like 400 that stayed nonstop on. So that's 400 around the world who actually are doing the workout. And that is only for my Facebook and YouTube account. I don't know what Fight TV has. So I think I'm going to get those numbers next week. And, of course, Facebook, they will say you get 14,000 views, you know, but people check in and then they go again. But the ones that are completely steady the whole time, it's like about 400, 420. So, and I already said, I listen, hey, if 10 people do it, I'm already a happy man. So if you can make 10 people happy, it's great, but it's better. So I like it.
And if you want to, you know, stay in shape and do some great cardio and obviously learn from a master, there's probably no one better than you as far as doing those kind of exercises and workouts and kickboxing and things like that, right?
Well, there's a lot of great coaches nowadays. So, but I'm a little different, you know. I have a different stance, different thinking, way of thinking. I kind of came up with my whole style. How do I say? There's some, like, blading, standing in the blading stance in mixed martial arts. I think it makes absolutely no sense to me. You know, you're shutting down the whole left side of your body. That is, of course, if you're right-handed. You know, you don't. But if you have an open stance, like a Mike Tyson would fight in the early days, you know, you almost have equal power in both hands, both legs, checking everything, blocking, countering. Everything becomes better. But the only thing that those so-called professional boxing trainers say, yeah, you're a wide open target because you're standing open against your opponent. But, you know, all the people that I mentioned, I said Chuck Liddell fights like that. Rumble Deggers used to fight like that. I fought like that. Mike Tyson fought like that. None of us went ever down to the body. And I go like, well, if it's such a easy target, why wouldn't we never go down to the body? But that's, of course, because you know you're an open target and your defense automatically becomes better there. I actually really use it against my opponent, you know, because they think I'm open. They're going to start hitting body shots. And, of course, I know what body shot it's going to be, so I have a nice left hook counter or a right hook counter waiting for them.
How would you kind of describe your fighting style, really, if you think about it? Because, like you said, you were more open. You definitely had a little bit of different way of thinking, definitely a different style. Would you say it's like almost like a kickboxing-esque, but almost you could throw in some catch wrestling and some shoot style? Like, how would you describe your fighting style?
You know, yeah, that's weird to say. So I look at just the people that inspire me always the most. Now, the hardest puncher on the planet is Mike Tyson. The most powerful kickboxer ever lived, who unfortunately passed away, Rommel Dekkers. And Mike is standing wide open. And I thought, why would he do that? And then suddenly I realized, wait a minute, you got almost equal power in your left and your right. I actually tested it one time. I had 100% punch on my right hand, and my left, while I'm standing with my left leg at the front, was 93%. So it was only 7% lighter than my right hand. And not even with a load up, so just standing with my left foot front, but just because I was standing square. So I go, wait a minute, now checking low kicks becomes easier. Checking kicks to the body becomes easier. Not only that, it's much easier to counter them as well. So that I took and I just brought it to the next level, so to say, because I karate punches. I don't like twisting your punch. You know, everybody says you have to rotate your punch at the end. And I'm all cool with that if it comes naturally. But if you tell somebody to do it, they start doing it right from where the punch takes off. So they're kind of telegraphing, because that's where I used to look at that elbows. I look at your body. If I see an elbow move, I already know a straight punch is coming. It's hard to explain on the phone like this, but take it from me. It really works. And then my submission game, that came from myself. I never had a coach. I had a coach, Chris Dolman. He taught me all the basics, but all the stuff, all the setups, I just found one guy, Leon Van Dyke in Holland, and we started both just training, watching fights, watching videos, and then I realized, wait a minute, I can actually make this move better, you know, and if I cannot make it better for everybody, at least I can make it better for me, you know, and then once we start experimenting and realizing, wait a minute, everybody knows a straight armbar from a mount position. What if I come up with a different way to go to that armbar? If you can create a way that your opponent never saw before, that's when you get successful. And then I realized also, wait a minute, that's just one way. What if I have four different ways for every submission? And I can start flipping them around. I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 4, boom, boom, suddenly I catch them again. So, and that started to do with every single technique. And then I said, wait a minute, if I'm escaping, rotating or reversing somebody, why won't I go right away into a counterattack? Because if you reverse somebody, in their mind they go like, oh man, you know, and they shouldn't think, oh man, because at that moment they think, oh man, I'm already going in for a counterattack. And, you know, and then it just became super successful suddenly. Listen, once I did I lost my last fight by submission, and then I just got so obsessed with submission suddenly, because I knew I needed to learn it. I won my next 8 fights by submissions, and I never lost a fight again, you know, only because I made the decision, now only going to focus on the ground game. But, you know, when I say only focus, when I get obsessed, I get obsessed. That means waking up in the middle of the night, dreaming a submission, waking up my wife, putting in the submission, asking where it hurts. Oh, yeah, walking to the house. Hey, honey, lean over. She goes, oh, here we go again. Is this a choke? Do you get hurt now, or you get dizzy? She said, I'm getting dizzy. I said, that's a blood choke. Okay, I would write it down. So it was the only thing I was doing all day long. And, you know, just like everything else, if you do it all day long and you fall in love with something, you're going to do it a lot. And then you automatically, of course, become good at it. And it's just because it was all a little different than the normal people would roll, I explode into submissions. I have always hand control. I don't like people grab by the wrist because they get turned their arms. I came up with crazy escapes. I won fights with moves that I made up, you know, which I told the dressing room. I said, watch, I'm going to do the boss with the neck right today. I'm going to finish somebody. What is it? I said, just watch. 4 minutes into the fight, got him in the boss with the neck, and boom. You see, that stuff I really enjoy. Looking back on it, you know, coming up with your own moves and then actually winning a fight with it. That's cool stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned kind of losing, and I guess you're talking about when you were submitted by Ken Shamrock and then kind of went on that huge roll, basically win 21 fights to end the career. But the losses to Ken Shamrock, you're saying like that kind of you became obsessed because of the submission loss and you want to make sure you perfected that?
Yeah, that was 100%. You know, I'm a very sore loser. And especially at that time, you know, because everything is you know, play cards with me, I want to win. You know, whatever it is, I always want to win. You know, it's just I'm wired like that. And I said, no, I don't want to lose anymore. You know, now I might get lucky one time and win a title, you know, but, you know, I always think that if you have a title, you have to at least defend it one time, you know, to solidify it, to make sure, because everybody can get lucky, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if I... maybe in another match I would lose by submission again. So it was either I'm going to stop with this whole sport or I'm going to learn the submission game. And then I just suddenly fell in love with the submission game, which I never expected. And that's when everything started escalating. Yeah, that's when I just started submitting other people. I mean, I rolled with really good guys on the planet. I've never had trouble with people. It's really weird. And they all tell me, he said, Ben, where did you learn that? I go, just myself, you know, because I'm so awkward the way I attack. They just never seen it, and that's why I can trick them here and there. So, and once, like a guy like BJ Penn, now I remember, I didn't know BJ personally at the time. He called me, that was for his fight against Matt Hughes. That's how long ago. And I know that because he said he was just going to take a jog to prepare himself for that fight. And I go, why are you calling me? He goes, I'm watching your instructional DVDs. I go, so? And he goes, dude, they're freaking unbelievable. He said, who was your coach? I said, I never had a coach. I said, so who came up with that hand control that you always do, I said, I did. He says, why? Because yeah, otherwise you can't roll out. He goes, man, I love that. It was really good. I'm very impressed. So just before he hang up, I go, whoa, BJ, wait, can I use that quote? Because, you know, coming from you, a freaking ground fighting specialist,
mm-hmm.
you know, to give me such a compliment, I would love to have the quote from you. He says, yeah, of course, use it. So that was a nice phone call, you know. Then you know you did something correct.
Absolutely. Now you're kind of like self-taught as far as submissions and stuff. But how the heck did he get to Pancrase? How did you make it over there? Because that's the OG. I mean, people always think UFC and stuff, but Pancrase is really OG of MMA. So how did you get in that world?
Like the guy Chris Dolman. He was the owner. He was the Dutch owner from the organization Rings. Remember that organization?
Yes.
Right there?
Oh, yeah.
But,
yep.
But rings were a lot of works. You know, like 90% of the 80% of the fights were, you know, like pro wrestling almost. But
yes.
Because
yep.
they were moving real, so it looked real. Later on in their career, when Dan Henderson and all these guys came, that's when they started to become a legit shoot fighting organization. But anyway, he called me one day, and he, you got to jump in your car right now because Amsterdam at that time of day, it's like a 2.5-hour drive for me. He says, we have two Japanese guys here, Funaki and Suzuki. They're from a new organization. I don't even know the name, he said, but they're looking for fighters. They're going to start this year. That was 93. He said, please come by. They want to videotape you, and maybe, you know, if they like you, then you can fight for the organization. You can make some money in Japan. I go, cool. So I jumped in my car, went over there, and I had to roll a spar, Thai boxing, against one of his champions from Rings. And the guy started going really hard against me. So I told him, I said, dude, just slow down. There's no need to go hard. You know, they just want to see technique. And I think he thought that I was afraid or so because he turned it up. So I told him again, I said, listen, I'm okay with this. But it's not going to be one-way traffic, you know. I'm going to do it back. You understand this, right? And, of course, now it was on right away. But it was short because I head kicked him right away. Really nice roundhouse kick. He went down. He needed a whole bunch of stitches, and that was it. Funaki and Suzuki, I saw him pointing at me, and they said we want him. And I think 3 months later or so, 2.5, 3 months later, I was in Japan, September 93. It was crazy.
Masukatsu Funaki, absolute legend, and then obviously Minoru Suzuki, another absolute legend in kind of MMA, but also pro wrestling world as well. So pretty interesting group of characters as far as that first group of Pancrase. I mean, Vernon White, Takahashi's in there, obviously Ken and Frank Shamrock, Jason DeLucia. It's so many kind of cool and interesting and big names, right? I mean, you guys had Maury Smith, too, to throw him out there. Quite a roster to start out.
Yeah, no, you know, a lot of these guys became, from Pancras, became UFC champions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Think about it. I mean, You got Ken Shamrock, Frank Shamrock. You got Guy Matzko won the four-man tournament. Maury Smith won. George Barnett won. I won a title. Takahashi did really good, beat Valid Ismail. And, I mean, you know, if you think about that, these are six champions coming from one organization. So we knew we were doing something good in Pancras. And I truly believe it was the rules, which everybody goes like, it's kind of weird rules, like the rope escapes and all that stuff. I thought it was freaking awesome because people, I have 14 submission victories. But my real number is like 43. I have 43 submissions in Pancras. But if I would get them in a submission, they would lay close to the rope and they could touch the rope. I had to let them go. But then they would get a lost point, the same as getting an 8 count, so to say. So if you, at the end of the fight, if I made you grab the rope once and I never grabbed the rope, then I would win automatically. If I would knock you down one time, 8 count, and I never went down after a fight, also I would win. So the cool thing was that some fights, like for instance, I had a fight against Yanagisawa. My first fight was against him, was 43 seconds. And my second fight against him was 27 minutes, I believe, because the first punch I threw, I broke my hand on his head. And the very first punch, immediately. And so I couldn't strike anymore. So I started taking him down and I went for a submission game. And I submitted him 5 times because, well, that was a 30-minute fight. And in 30 minutes, you know, 5 lost points. So if I would knock him down twice and 3 times submit him, but he can grab a rope, that will be a loss. So the 5th submission, finally, you know, which was the last one, he had only 5. I got him, I believe, it was a rear naked choke or something. But you see what I mean now? Now I went to a fight and kind of had 5 fights instead of 1 fight.
Right.
Because every time when you submit somebody and they grab a rope, you start back on your feet again. Boom, now fight. So you... All these guys in Pancras had way more ring time than anybody else because, you know, you started on your feet again and now it was another fight. So I think that's why these guys were excelling at the submission game and in other organizations because they just had way more experience.
Absolutely. Makes perfect sense, too. And I love that, you know, as you're kind of going through, right, you lose to Funaki submission and Ken Shamrock a few times submission, and you had a loss to Ken, and then a loss to Frank Majority. But like you said, then you start learning the ground game, then you start learning the submissions, then you beat Frank Shamrock, then you beat Minoru Suzuki for the King of Pancrase, then rematch against Frank Shamrock, you beat him again to unify and basically defend your King of Pancrase title. So, I mean, you're really kind of learning your craft, and you're beating some pretty damn good, some of the greatest of all time.
Yeah, that was a good time. You know what? The thing was with me, I had no clue that I was going so well. It was so weird. I remember one person said one time, that was, I believe, Yanagisawa. He said to me, wow, boss, you already won like 11 fights in a row. And I go, what? He goes, you won 11 fights in a row. And I go, oh, shit. He goes, what? I said, I wish you wouldn't have said that. He says, what do you mean? I said, well, now I start thinking about that. I had no clue that I was just winning. I never counted it. You know, I go like, and I don't want to know because it takes extra pressure again, you know, because now you're going to go to 12 or to 13, you know. So to wrap it up with a 22-fight unbeaten streak, you know, thankfully the Lord gave me some injuries because I would have been that knucklehead who would kept on fighting, you know, and eventually you are going to lose. And you, take a look at Ken Shamrock. I love the guy. Great fighter, but, you know, he really tarnished his career at the end, you know, because just he wanted to keep on fighting, you know, and that. It didn't work anymore. I feel so bad because he was such a great guy. And then you wrap it up with, like, I don't know how many losses, you know. I'm happy that I had the injuries. Of course, I wasn't happy when I received them. But now I know it was for a reason, just to protect me and make sure that I was not going to do the same path, keep on fighting. And eventually, you're going to lose to these young guys. Come on.
Yeah, if you think about it, if Ken would have retired like when he really first retired, he probably would have been known as one of the greatest of all time. But now people are like, oh, he lost to here or he lost to Tito a bunch or whatever. But it's really because he kind of came back injured, beat up, out of his prime, but he just kept fighting anyway.
That was the thing with him. You know, people can say whatever they want about pro wrestling. Pro wrestling is super tough, man. I'm telling you, I did pro wrestling in Japan. My first 3 matches, first I broke my disc in my back. Second, I ruptured my eyeball. Third one, I broke an eardrum, which I couldn't repair because I fly. You cannot fly for 4 weeks well, I always fly. So that for 6 years, I could literally blow bubbles out of my ears. All the people, all the falls they make are real, everything, you know. And I think that when Ken went to the WWE, I think, you know, so many shows, I think that's where he got injured. And then after that, he started fighting again. I didn't think that was a good decision. I think something happened at the WWE that really messed up his body. And Ken is just a guy who loves the sport. And I talked to him about it. He says, boss, I can't let it go. I don't care. I just want to I like to compete. And I completely understand that, you know, if you want to do it. But then, you know, try to pick people from your own age or, you know, do something else. But, you know, of course, I'm saying this now, but if I would be fighting, I would never want to fight a guy my own age as well. You know, you want to still go and see, test your skills against everybody else. So, and like I said, if I wouldn't have had injuries, I might have done the same thing as Ken was doing, you know, and eventually, yeah, well, you are going to lose against guys half your age.
And think about, like, when you got hurt, your UFC World Heavyweight Champion, you had just beaten Kevin Randleman for the title right before you beat TK, also in UFC, so you're undefeated in UFC, and you're the world champion. Was that kind of hard to have happen to you at that particular moment? Not looking back, but at that time.
It was hard. But you know what? There was a thing that made it a little easier, because what happened was that Frank was the champion, and suddenly Frank didn't want to fight. That was just, and then the UFC says, okay, Frank, Boss is going to fight Tito Ortiz. So I was going to face Tito, and then Frank called and he says, no. I'm going to fight Tito because I'm the champion, and once I beat Tito, I'm fighting Boss. And okay, good. So at least, okay, now I got my way in, you know. But then he beat Tito and he retired because he was also banged up. So now suddenly that fight was gone. And I go, okay, but, you know, I had a few fights in me. I already had my tendonitis, which I had to be very careful about because it was killing me. It's like an insane pain. I always tell people, you have no clue how much that hurts. It's like nothing like it. It's a very annoying pain. And if it starts like 4 weeks before a fight, well, then for the next 4 weeks, two times a day, because that's when I work out, I'm going to be in insane pain. I have about 45 minutes without pain, and you can put the clock on it. 45 minutes to start, and that's an hour and a half, 2 hours. Just, I mean, I would lose weight from the pain. I couldn't eat from the pain. I was so, and there's nothing you can take. It's not like you take pain pills because you're going to have to fight, you know? So it's
right.
Not going to work. So, yeah, that was hard. So, but I said, you know what? I have this. I'm going to get the champion. And then, I said it in the wrong order. So first I became the UFC heavyweight champion.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
Think about this. I was 197 before. I literally had to drink waters at my weigh-in to go over 200 pounds because I was too light. And I was already with my jeans and everything standing on the weigh scale. He says, you're 197. You can fight, but it cannot be for the title. I said, why not? You need to be over 200. So I drank all the waters that my buddies were having, and then I got 203. So I said, okay, so after this fight, I became the champion. Now I'm going to be the first one in history who's going to go to the, I believe they called it middleweight. There was heavyweight and middleweight. There was no light heavyweight. I believe it was.
Yes, correct. Yep.
And Frank was the middleweight champion. I said, okay, I want to be the first one in history who has two belts in two different divisions. And then I went down to there, and then that whole thing happened. That, you know, I was Frank was going to fight. He didn't want to fight. Then so I want to fight Tito. Then he said, no, I want to fight Tito. Then he fought Tito, and then he was going to fight me, and that never happened. And as soon as that happened, my motivation was also gone because I had already the injuries, and I figured for one more fight to get a title fight right away in the middleweight division, you know, I can pluck through that. You know, I can deal with the pain for another 2 months, but at least I have that chance because it would be cool, you know, to be the very first one in history to do that. And unfortunately, it never happened. So,
yeah, injuries kind of ended that bit, and then obviously Frank ends up retiring, really, and kind of screws up things a little bit for UFC. How come you returned in 2006 against Ruben Villarreal?
You know, there was two reasons. The main reason it was money. You know, there was I was doing a lot of things, but you know, I still wanted the money, and I wanted to go to a house. And I don't live in a big house, but just a house with a pool in the back. And so, but I was also drinking heavily at the time. Like a lot. I was drinking a lot because once you stop fighting, you know, you try to find a replacement for that high that you're getting, I guess. I don't know. And a lot of athletes go through this, whether it's football or whatever sport it is, that's either alcohol or drugs that they got to go to. And for me, it was alcohol. And then it was something where they offered the fight, and it was a great amount of money. I believe it was $225,000. And you know, the most I made was in the UFC was like 60, I think, which was at the time really great because that was for the whole tournament normally, 60,000. So that was already great. But now to have this money, I say, okay, I'm going to do it because if I say yes to the fight, I'm going to have to stop drinking, you know, because then you can't drink and train. It's not going to work. So... And thankfully, it happened like that, you know. So I took the fight. I also thought my injuries were gone, which were not gone. They came back after 4, 5, 6 weeks. They all came back, and then some, with a vengeance. But, you know, at least it made me stop drinking. And from that moment on, I never fell back to that crap, you know. So, for me, yeah, it was drinking, but also for the money. But the drinking was the number one priority.
That is... pretty kind of crazy to think like, okay, you know, if I start training again, maybe I'll stop drinking, you know, kind of an interesting way to kind of go about life, right? I mean, definitely a interesting decision. Like, hey, you know what will make me stop drinking? Get back out there and train to fight.
Listen, I won 21 fights in a row at that time. So
yeah, oh,
I was not going to lose that last fight. So, you know, if I would be still an alcoholic, you know, then I would be...
Mm-hmm.
Then I maybe would train half, but no, I really want to win, and I know myself, so I know that I do not want to lose. That means that I'm going to be forced to stop drinking. There's no way I can drink and train, you know. So yeah, thankfully it worked out that way.
You're also known as it's because you win that fight via leg kick, but you're also known as it's just a great kicker and deliver kicks and things like that. Kickboxing and kicking and like the karate aspect of it, was that always something that you were into even as a youngster?
Yeah, you know, it was a Bruce Lee movie. You know, I had this horrible skin disease that had severe asthma, so I was this very skinny kid with eczema on his hands and face and his ears. They called me the leper, you know. So needless to say, I was bullied a lot as a kid. And then when I saw a Bruce Lee movie when I was 12, Enter the Dragon, that changed everything, you know. And then I asked my parents if I could start training. It took me 2 years to convince them. But finally, when I started training, it was Taekwondo. I mean, within 2.5 months, I was training with the adults. I was fortunate to have a very beautiful neighbor girl. There were actually two of them. But one of them, she's beautiful, and she was dating the cool guy in town. Xavier was his name. And he always kind of helped me because he saw I was bullied, you know, and he was a very nice guy to me. And he took me with him to the adult classes. And, yeah, within months, I stopped beating the adults, you know. So then I overheard the adults talking about me in the dressing room, in the locker room. Man, this kid is good. So when you hear as a kid only negativity about you, but then suddenly adults start speaking highly of you, you know, that led to, of course, the first street fight, my first big fight with the biggest bully in my school, who shouted against something, hey, leper, whatever. At this time, I shouted something back. I was riding my bicycle, and he was with like six of his buddies, and I heard them laugh, and I'm looking back, and sure enough, they started to chase me, and I said, this is it. I'm going to face it now. So I put my bike on the stand, and I just waited for them, and they surrounded me with the bikes. And the tough guy, Shaki, came and he started bumping his chest. And come on, leper hit me. So I knocked him out. it was one punch, you know. And then I realized, wait a minute, it was actually really easy, you know. And then, of course, the bullying stopped 95% in one punch. I cleared it all out. And then I started going after all the bullies that bullied me in the past. I made a list. And I went after everybody. And it was really sad at certain times because some of these guys, they were so bad to me. But once I got them, they didn't even remember what they said. I said, well, I remember it. And that's what counts because it's still in my head. And I would just beat them up, you know. But then I realized, wait a minute, I got a feel for it. So then when I started Thai boxing, well, I started knocking out people left and right. And then, you know, and I just really enjoyed the striking. I have to say also, when I was 21, I started... a karate form. It was called Shintai Karate. It was with like little trips here and there, but really nothing advanced. But the striking was great. But what was more better was the instructor. His name was Roland, and he was a really great instructor. Knew how to, you know, exactly how to where to get the power from. And then, of course, once I start watching fights like Ramon Dekkers, you know, and you once you see power like that, you know, I'm always been good with whatever I see. I can break it down in my head and see if I can generate the same kind of stuff. I just start imitating. And then, you know, once you start imitating, you realize, wait a minute, it's getting really strong. So that's what I did, just paying a lot of attention to the biggest punches, the biggest kickers, and putting that in my own system. And thankfully, I was able to do it. So, yeah, I always mesmerized with kicking really hard. I always enjoyed that.
And it really, I mean, you were prolifically one of the best strikers, and you're saying a lot of stuff came easy. So when you are the leper and you're getting bullied and you're kind of getting through, how does the leper with eczema and all that other stuff, how does he become El Guapo?
You know, that's from a movie. That's from the Three Amigos with Martin Short, Chevy Chase, Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my favorite movies. It's such a funny humor. It's so cheesy, but it's hilarious. And the bad guy in that movie, his name is El Guapo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So in 2000, we're at the Pride Fighting Championships. Ken Shamrock is there with Tina Shamrock, his wife at the time. And then, of course, Mark Coleman is there, who won the whole thing. But Kevin Randleman is there. And in the mornings, those are the best times, man. I'm always telling you, you can ask any fighter, they probably say the same thing, who fought at Pride. The breakfast at the Tokyo Hilton in Japan, forget about it. Best breakfast. I've been around the world. I've been to 5-star hotels. But that breakfast, and every fighter will tell you the same, was just insanely good. But the good thing is, like Japan with the time difference, that means that you wake up at 4 in the morning, you have to wait 2 hours for the breakfast to open up, and you're super hungry because it's daytime for you already. So everybody's waiting at like 5:30 because at 6 o'clock they open up, and all these fighters are there. They would go into the breakfast place, and most of the time we go sit at one big table. Everybody start telling jokes and eating food and, you know, having a great time. There's always laughing, and it's such a good time. It's something that I really miss. I talk to a lot of fighters about this, and they say the same thing. But anyway, that time, we had Mark Coleman, Kevin Randleman, and then Tina Shamrock, Ken Shamrock, and some other people were sitting at our table. Mauro Ranallo was there. Stephen Quadros is there at the time because Mauro wasn't in there yet. And we're talking about the movie The Three Amigos. And since Tina Shamrock, she's from Mexico, so I asked her suddenly, because I used to call myself the most handsome fighter in NHB, No Holds Barred. That's what I said for fun.
Yep.
And so I asked her, I said, oh, man, it's a funny movie. I said, what does it mean, El Guapo? And she says, that means the handsome. So I started laughing. I said, that's hilarious, because the guy in the movie, he's an ugly guy, but they call him El Guapo because everybody's afraid of him. I thought it was hilarious. That was it. And then suddenly when I believe Kevin Randleman, he started it. When he got up, he says, okay, Wapo, we'll see you in a bit. And he walked off. And that was it. Like everywhere I went, suddenly people go, hey, Wapo, this. So that was Kevin Randleman, who started it in 2000 when we found out that El Wapo means the handsome.
Great. I love that. And Pride those days, whew, everyone kind of thinks UFC like the best or number one. No, Pride. That's where it was. Best production, best fighters, best arenas, best announcers, including you. I mean, it was like the perfect mix of everybody. How did you get involved with like the announce game and Pride? Because you fit them like a glove. I mean, that team, you and Quadros and you and Mauro, awesome teams.
You know what? I was so fortunate. Listen, I never thought about commentating, but I was training Marker for the Pride Fighting Championships. So I went with him to the show, and that was already in 98 and 99. He was already competing there. And in 2000, they were going to have the tournament, which is the one that Mark Coleman won. But anyway, so I'm watching. I'm sitting behind stage, and suddenly we're watching the fights on a TV that's on in the dressing room, you know, before Mark fights, because Mark was so good, he was always the main event. So we were just sitting there warming him up and watching the other fights. And we had some people from Pride Fighting Championships were sitting with us as well, from the organization. And I'm watching, and I go, oh, okay, oh, he's going to get armbarred. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, he's going to get armbarred. He said, but he's not doing anything. I said, give it 10 seconds. So we'll be there. Oh, see, there it is. And the guy won by armbar. So they look at me and go, how did you know that? I said, well, you can tell. You know, you can see what he's setting up and the way he does it. And the next fight, I believe it was Carlos Newton against Sakuraba. And Sakuraba was an all fours. And Carlos is sitting behind him. And he has one knee in between his legs. I go, oh, he's going to roll into a knee bar. He's got to watch out. He's going to roll him into a knee bar. And I go again. You know, he said, what do you mean? I said, just give it some time. Oh, there we go. Boom, and he got him in the knee bar. And they were like, what the heck? He said, listen, next month or the next show, we're going to broadcast to the States because it's going to be a tournament. And we need announcers. Would you like to be an announcer? And I go, sure, you know, I had no clue about announcing, trust me. You know how much I didn't understand about announcing? This is the dumbest thing. That's how you can see how stupid I can be sometimes. So I say yes to the job. I come at the event. We're doing the show. I'm walking into the bus to go to the event. And somebody asked me, I'm there in my shorts and flip-flops and a Hawaiian flower shirt. And they say, where's your suit? And I go, excuse me? And he goes, suit. I go, what do you mean? He says, are you serious? I go, what do you mean? He says, you need a suit, boss. I said, why would I need a suit? I'm behind a microphone. I never paid attention to people opening the show. I never did that. I thought it was just a voice. And they go, are you serious? I go, I swear to God, I didn't bring a suit. You know, so they're freaking out. And thankfully, Michael Braverman, who was doing the production at the time, was a really good guy. He says, no, we'll work with it. We'll work with it. He says, okay, let's get Stephen Quadros. He is in the arena, and then we come up with something funny, you know, like Boss is backstage. You got these 8 Japanese geishas in robes. They're fanning me down, feeding me grapes, and I'm telling war stories. You know, like, oh, I was there, you know, 12 guys were ready to attack me, but girls, don't worry, you know. Mm-hmm. And while I'm talking like that, Stephen Quadros is doing the announcing on the inside from the arena, and he says, hey, Boss, what are you doing? Let's throw it back to Boss. And then it goes to me in the dressing room at the geishas, and I, you know, I talk about the fight, and they send it back. But that suddenly became this big thing in Pride, you know, because that was the opening of the show, and everybody enjoyed it so much that from that moment on, every time we, you know, in the beginning when you watch Pride Fighting Championships, we would always open with a skit. You know, but that came because of the first time, because I forgot my suit. I forgot. I didn't even know I had to wear a suit. So we were forced to do that, and that became a shtick, and suddenly we had to do it every show. It was funny.
That's awesome. That is great. You didn't even realize it. That is great. I love it. Accidentally, because people probably thought that was all a skit that you set up previously, you know, with the production team stuff. That is great that it's basically all natural.
That's it, man. I love it. When things comes natural, you know, that's when it starts. Then we did the opening with Alistair Overeem, with Quentin Jackson, with waiting in line at the Tokyo Dome. And, I mean, we did such a funny openings. But, again, it all comes just because I didn't bring a suit the first time I had to do the show.
That is great. How did you actually, like, enjoy announcing? Because you were such a natural. You were so good. And even some things off the cuff, like you would go crazy for Fedor's theme song, which is just great because at home you're kind of thinking the same thing. Like, oh, this song is great. Like, and you're like, this is the greatest song. Like, you were such a natural, but you were so relaxed. How do you kind of explain that? Like, you're so good, but, like, there's no pressure to it.
Yeah, that was the thing. You know, for me, the pressure would be, like, the opening of the show or the things. But, you know, I would, once I see fighting, I become, you know, it becomes like I'm fighting. I'm saying this is because people always go, oh, you weren't nervous when you're fighting. I said, no, I really wasn't. I might be in the dressing room a little there and there, but, you know, I knew for myself that once I walk to the ring and the cage, whatever it is, I'm completely in the zone. I feel great. I'm, you know, I can't hear any, I'm in this bubble where nobody can touch me. And so once I start commentating, I guess it was just like that. I don't care if people, how many times people are screaming in my ear, like when I do for NBC or something. Like, don't, because I just start singing. I don't know that I'm doing it, really. I'm not planning anything. All the lines that I said, you know how many times that when you hear Mataleo, apparently the only way to kill a lion is to choke it out. I said, I would just kick it in the head. Like these comments that I all read, all these lines that I said, I had no clue I said that. That I literally had to go back and listen. I go, oh, yeah, I really said that. That's weird. You know, because I just do whatever I want to do at that moment, whether it's a singing a Justin Bieber song or, you know, it's not, it's never forced. It always comes naturally. I never thought about it. And apparently the people liked it somehow, you know, so because it was different, I guess. I don't know. I, you know, that's the thing with me again. I never pay attention to that and also not what people say. I just want to do my own things. If I'm not allowed to do it, they will tell me in my ear, my IFB, hey, Bush, can't do this anymore. And then I will never do that anymore. But unless they stop me, I just keep doing what I'm doing. And thankfully, the people were okay with it.
So good and so natural. And like you said, you would just watch something like Sakuraba do something crazy or you think silly. You're like, nope, I know what he's up to. So you were one of those guys that you obviously were one of the greatest fighters of all time, but you can parlay that into talking to the people and letting them know in kind of simpler terms. You know what I mean? Like you were very natural at making it easier for the fans watching it to kind of learn what's going on, albeit why they're watching a crazy sport.
You know, that's such a cool thing because you're not the only one who says that to me. I have so many fans who tell me, man, I learned so much from the sport by listening to you. And my other commentators always ask me, what do you do different, Buzz? What should I do? I say, treat everybody at home as a white belt. That's what I do. That's mm-hmm. the only thing that I do because, you know, many times, you know, a wrestler says, oh, he's got to run the pipe. 99% of the people at home have no clue what you just said. Run the pipe. What is run the pipe? Well, explain. And that's what I do. You know, I say something, and then I say, oh, for the people at home who don't understand that, this is what it is, and I explain what it is. You know, so I just treated everybody at home as a white belt, so I gave him some information. And then also to not offend other people, I said, well, a lot of these fighters who are watching know this, but a lot of other people who don't know it, and for those people, this is what this is. And then I just explain it. You know, so to me, I didn't do anything. I think it's the teacher for me. I always really enjoy teaching, and I like setups, and I love creativity. And that together with just teaching everybody, yeah, as they are a black, white belt. You know, it has to be it. Because with the streamings, I do these streamings. And mm-hmm. I was talking about it for the last 4 weeks now almost. We've been doing it every day. And I know that I'm repeating myself every single time. And I said, listen, I know I say this all the time. Rotate your upper body. Does this. But all the things that I'm saying are so important, I just want to hammer it in there. And then I point to Dana. She's the girl who does it with me. And I always say, if she heard this at least 500 times from me, they have to get sick of me saying this. You know, because I'm all about the basics and hammering it in. And the fun part was that one time we had a student who came, he trained for us for 6 weeks or so. And at the end, he tried to be cool, I guess. And he goes, hey, boss, in the middle of the class. He goes, you know what's funny? I said, tell me what's funny. He says, for the last 6 weeks, you've been saying the same stuff over and over again. I go, yeah. I say, you want to hear something more funny? And he goes, what? I say, you're still not doing what I told you to do. and everybody started laughing. I said, no, this literally is because of people like you and like everybody else here. I can say it as many times as you want, but until not everybody's doing it, I will keep saying it. Once everybody complies and they do it, you will never hear me say it again. I said, but the only reason I'm saying it is because of knuckleheads like you, because I have to, because you're still not doing it. So that's always how I've been training. So I can repeat myself a lot. But it's all for a reason. I just wanted to ingrain it in your mind that you'll never forget it.
Love that. And I just thought you and Stephen Quadros and then even you and Mauro Ranallo, of course, had such great chemistry. Easy working with those guys?
Super easy, man. Quadros always been super easy. Such a pleasure to work with. The fight professor, crazy information that he all the time has, you know, and I think he's also a little off, just like me. We have this crazy humor, but, you know, he needed to play more the straight guy because if we're both going to do it, you know, then, of course, it's not going to be as fun. And he's always be a guy who says, oh, guys, relax, chill down. And that was, thankfully, he took that role, but don't believe for a second that he's not funny because he's hilarious. And sometimes he'll come out. Sometimes he says really funny things. But, you know, and it's the same with Mauro. You know, Mauro is also the guy who, you know, I met Mauro, I think 4 years before the Pride Fighting Championship. We were doing a movie together. We were the announcers in some really bad movie, and where where they were going to do, we were going to do the commentary, and that they would make, base, they would, this is the craziest thing you ever heard. They were going to make a fight, and they will build it around our commentating. So not like they fight first and then we commentate. No, we commentate and they build a fight. And I go, guys, that's never going to work. That will never work, 100%. I said, but hey, you're paying, right? Yeah. I said, okay, let's do it. I don't care, you know, if you'll figure that out later. As long as you're paying, it's good. So Mauro walks in. And Mauro, I never, and at first it started with, I have 6-page script that I'm already for 20 minutes trying to hammer it in my head because there's a lot of freaking lines that we have to do. And we had to be on camera for something. And Mauro walks in. I gave him a script. He's literally, I'm talking 3 minutes. And he throws the script away. He said, okay, let's start. And I go, what do you mean? I say, you got it? And he goes, yeah. I go, bull crap, man. And he goes, no. So I go to page 3 and I say a line and he answers. And I go, holy crap. He memorized the 6 pages in freaking three minutes? How is it even possible, you know? So I go, man. And then I heard his voice and we start playing around. And I mean, they have to stop the production a bunch of times because people were dying laughing because we were just cracking jokes while we do the commentating. I look at him, I say, man, give me your name, you know, you need to be on TV. I mean, what a talent you got. You know, this is insane. And then I say, you never know if something happens, you know. And that happened in like 2004 or 5 when they didn't want to work with Quadros anymore. They asked me first if I knew somebody. And you know what? I'm good friends with Steven. And I thought that if I'm going to get Mauro in, Steven might think that I said this. I felt really bad about the whole situation. So I said, no. And they got Damon Perry at the time. Damon Perry was a radio host. So this guy kept on talking, my friend. Oh, you have no. There is a moment during the fight that I literally put my hand on his mouth, like literally physically shut the hell up. Let me talk. You have no clue what goes on, but you keep on talking. You know, it's insane. So that didn't work out. And then they say, you really don't know anybody? I go, you know, actually I do. I hope the number still works. This is 4 years ago. And I left a message. And Mauro went through a really bad time at the time. He's bipolar, as everybody knows. They made a Showtime documentary about him, The Bipolar Rock and Roller. You can watch it on Showtime.
Yep.
And he just came out of the crazy house because he got really crazy. And his mother said, hey, there's a guy with a weird accent on the answering machine. Maybe you should listen. He sends in the tape, and boom, they got him, man. And that was it. He was and I told him that. I think it was June or something. I said, you understand that you're going to be the best commentator in the world, right? You understand? He goes, no. I said, you watch. That year already, he was the first play-by-play guy immediately. And then he started winning every single year as best play-by-play guy. And I go, I told you. And every year he would call me with Christmas and New Year's, crying on the phone. Thank you so much. I go, dude, it's not me. It's you. Because if you would have sucked, you know, I could have never done that. But you have so much talent. The world just needs to know that. And I was so happy I could do that for him. Because look at him now. I mean, Showtime Boxing. He's doing the WWE, the Bellator. I mean, he does everything at the highest level. He's just a really smart dude.
Yeah, he is excellent. He is amazing. And like you said, every sport he's great at. I mean, he is a master of the game. That's for sure. Now, as we head towards the finish, we head towards the wind down, I got to know where the root and jump, your infamous, you know, split-legged jump, where did that come from?
You know, that was just euphoria. That was what happened was I have pictures of me, one picture of me when I was 16 or 17 in the air, jumping in the splits. I used to do that just to show off, or you know, like, hey, fun. And when I knocked the first guy out, you have to understand that people have no clue. So I'm from Holland. I come from Thai boxing. I come from 5 rounds of 3 minutes, and weight classes are important. So now I go to Japan. I'm the first day in Japan, and I realize there's no weigh-in the day before, which I thought it was odd. You know, but, you know, I'm facing a Japanese guy. They're known for their honesty. So I'm pretty sure he's going to be on weight. So the next day I go to the show And this big guy comes to me and he shakes my hand. I say, oh, hey, very nice meeting you. Good, good. I say, oh, you're the promoter. He goes, no, no, I'm fighting you tonight. And I go, like, you're fighting me tonight. I say, what's your weight? And he goes, 235. I say, 235. He says, what are you? I say, 203. I think I was actually lighter at the time, 201 or something. So I'm going, is that not too heavy? And at that moment, the promoter walks over. And I say, hey, how are you? Nice meeting you. Yeah, good. I say, hey, listen, he's like 35 pounds heavier than I am. Is that okay? And he goes, yeah, yeah, no, there's no weight classes, Mr. Rhythm. I go, no weight classes. I go, okay, good. So I'm acting like I'm all happy. But, of course, inside I go, like, dude, now I'm facing a guy 35 pounds or 33 pounds heavier. This is crazy. So just before the guy walks away, I say, one more question, please. How many rounds are we fighting? He goes, one round. So I'm all happy. I ask how many minutes. He goes, 30. 30 minutes.
Mm.
And again, I'm forcing a smile. I go, great. I'm in great shape, you know. And I look at my manager and go, dude, what do we got here? I'm facing this guy, 32 pounds heavier than I am, in a 30-minute fight. This is crazy. So then when I went to the fight, and because my opponent was taller than me, I gave him a high kick. And right away, as soon as I planted my foot, I palm strike him because he was taller than me. So upward palm strike, and he went down. Then he got an 8 count, and I dropped him again. But I was so excited because there was so much stress before the fight that I don't know why. I just jumped up to the splits to all the corners of the ring, so to all the people, and then it became my jump. I remember the second time when I fought, I knocked the guy out to the knee to the liver, and I just wanted to go back. And the guy said, no, no, Mr. Root, you have to do jump. I go, what do you mean? You had a jump like last time. Okay, you want me to do this every time now? Yeah, I go, oh, here we go. You know, I got to do that, you know. And that fight, I was actually super tired. I was super sick. I was throwing up the whole day. They let me travel for 8 hours on the day of the fight to go to the fight. I didn't sleep like an hour because when they come from Holland and you go to Japan, well, nighttime is daytime. So there's no, like, 7 o'clock in the morning is the club 11 o'clock at night for you. So around 7, that's when you start getting tired. So, and then at 8 o'clock, they pick me up, let me travel to like 4 o'clock. They give me half an hour in my hotel to shower, and then I had to go to the arena. So I was pooped, man. I almost couldn't do the jumps afterwards. That's how much, how tired I was. But that's how it came, you know. I was just super excited and jumped up in the splits just because I did it before, I guess, when I was young.
It's one of those cool things if you look at, like, you know, like the Jordan logo, the Bas Rutten logo, you know, like the you doing the splits is kind of like a awesome logo, like trademark kind of thing. I just think it's awesome.
Yeah, I always, you know, I was deep down inside, I was kind of hoping because I liked the logo a lot. And I go, man, this is like you said, you know, with Nike, you know, the jump or you know, and there's one thing I said, man, that could be a cool logo, like, you know, enjoying life. It can mean everything, a jump like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But unfortunately, it never got that big.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you did mention pro wrestling as well, because you did work for, obviously, Inoki. You did Bumbai, you did Battle Arts, you did New Japan Pro Wrestling. You mentioned it was harder than people even really could imagine. Did you enjoy pro wrestling? I know you had the injuries and stuff too, but did you enjoy it at all?
I enjoyed it tremendously, you know, and I got such, and I had no clue who Lou Thesz was. Somebody said, man, this guy, Bas Rutten, he's doing really good. He's like a Lou Thesz. And I asked a friend of mine who was a pro wrestler. He goes, dude, that's like the biggest compliment you can get. That guy was a freaking machine. And I loved it, man. I really enjoyed it. You know, what people don't, well, some people know, but other people don't know, between Thai boxing, this is actually how Chris Dolman, the guy who invited me to come to Amsterdam for the tryout, he saw me at one of these shows that I did. We used to do martial arts shows. A friend of mine was my karate teacher, and we would go, like, for instance, do a nightclub, and at midnight, the music goes down, high-pitched music starts, like house music, and then he and I would come out in our spandex, pumped-up bodies, a bit long sticks, short sticks, nunchucks, and we have these fight scenes on the dance floor, and I would kick him in the gut. He would grab my foot. He would throw me back in a somersault. I would kick him in the face while flying, like really highly acrobatic things we would do. And that became a big thing suddenly in Holland. We started doing it for big organizations, for big Thai boxing events, for Dutch TV. Then it became European TV. We started traveling to Germany, to Berlin, to France. We started doing these shows all over the world. And that's on one of these shows. That's when Chris Dolman, and the guy I was talking about who invited me to Amsterdam for the tryout, that's why he stopped me. Because we would come up with backflips and go to the place where we had to do our demonstration. And he goes, dude, I remember you from Thai boxing. You were dropping everybody, you know, and now I see you doing all these backflips. Maybe you want a free fight. That's what they called it in the beginning. MMA was called free fighting. And I go, what is it? You know, but that's how, where my interest came from it. So I used to do these kind of fight shows already. So then going to pro wrestling, and I know my timing is great. I can kick you in the head that it looks like I just knock you out, but I can stop. I know I have that control. It's not a put a feather. I know I have that at least. So once Inoki understood that, you know, that became fun. Actually, a very funny story is my first show, I'm going against the number two of New Japan. I'm in the Tokyo Dome. We're talking 60,000 people. Right, in Tokyo Dome, Don Fry is in my corner. He fights later on the show. And, you know, a couple of days before, when you head up, you go over what you're going to have to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they go to a special place where nobody knows you are. You rehearse the opening, you rehearse the middle part, and you rehearse the end. That's how it goes. And then in between, you just ad lib, so to say. And the first thing was going to be, he was a big guy. He was going to throw me in the corner, and then he was going to give me an elbow, and then he was going to give me another elbow, and then he would wind up to the audience and go, oh, and then he would drop me with the third elbow. So the first elbow is perfectly timed. The second elbow is a freaking full hit in my face, and my mind goes in real mode, I guess. So I knock him out. I go like, boom, I go, bang, and he's out. He's laying on the ground, and I'm looking at Dolph Fry, and this was not in the script. You know, it was just because he hit me real hard, so I automatically just hit him really hard back. And Don has his hands in his hand, his hat in his hands, and he goes, oh, shit. So the referee starts walking around the pro wrestler, like two circles, and he goes, one, and he walks one circle around him, two. So he gives him a lot of time, and finally he woke up, you know, and then we continued our fight scene. So the next show, when I had that, right away, the guy that I had to fight, he said, Mr. Ruther, please, no real fight. I go, listen, it's very easy. You don't hit me hard, I don't hit you hard. I don't know what you guys are talking about, but you don't know that they're in the dressing room and say, hey, you know, Boss Ruther, you know, the UFC champion, watch tonight. I'm going to elbow him in the face. I don't know what they're going to say, right? They might well. So I'm not going to take any crap. You hit me hard. Well, I'm going to let you know how hard you hit me. I just do it back. So that's what happened. And but it was great, man. I loved it so much. Such a great people. The Mies, the Steiner brothers. Scott Steiner. Dude, just so much fun with these guys. She was living at the time in China. She was so awesome. We had such a great time with her. I mean, she was so crazy and out of control, but in a good way. You know, it was she's such a fun lady. All these people. I remember we were eating Korean barbecue in the Tokyo Dome restaurant. This is a big place. It's like the Tokyo Dome Hotel. They have a restaurant in there. Big thing. And the Steiner brothers were with us. And one said, order chicken. And they said they didn't have chicken. And he looks at me and he goes, I bet you they have chicken. I go, what are you going to do? So he gets up and he just walks into the kitchen. And he goes in the kitchen and suddenly I hear people scream, wah, 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 wah. He comes out with a plate full of chicken. People try to stop him and he just puts it down. Dude, it was insanity. What a good time, man. And Don Fry, what a man. What a freaking man's man, man. When he was completed at the peak of his career, oh, man. Such a good dude too, still till this day. But you know, he went through some battles. But at that time, that was the guy to have right next to you in a big street fight or in a bar fight. You know, it's gonna be okay. You know?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. In case anything went down, it's always good to have Don Fry on your side. That's for sure. As far as MMA world and your fighting and stuff,
any fights stick out to you? Do you have like a favorite fight, or is that kind of impossible to say?
Yeah, I'm happy you say that because they ask me every time, and I say exactly what you're saying. It's almost impossible. I like guys like TJ Dillashaw, of course, Dominic Cruz, the guys who are really weird. Israel Adesanya, even Joe Jones. You know, I wish that he toned down a little bit, but I think once he gets his, I hope he's going to get his life in order. You know that. I think if he. Man, what a talent. That guy is such an incredible talent. I love that. Yoel Romero, you know, just a guy that age and then still fighting at that time. But everybody, Max Holloway, every champion, I love the women. You know, it is so hard to say it just because of the reason that you already mentioned, because there's so many good fighters out there right now, and I just everybody needs a plug, man. I like Conor McGregor, what he did with bringing the attention to MMA, making it even bigger, you know, the way the showmanship, the way he's talking and the way he's all promoting events, you know, all that stuff I just love.
As far as Bas Rutten, MMA, wrestling, I mean, your kickboxing, your taekwondo, everything. When people, and you're commentating especially too, but when people look back at you and like you're retired or, you know, you're done with the business or whatever, you're basically in the rear view. What is the legacy? What's the stamp of Bas Rutten that you leave behind?
He was just a good guy. Yeah, the guy could kick ass, but, you know, he was a nice guy. He was good to people. He was, you know, respectful. You know, just there to, yeah, that's what I want people to know. You know, I never screwed anybody over. We had this whole thing with the bare knuckle organization. You probably heard about that whole thing. It's a way too long of a story to explain. But, you know, I had the guys, like, contacting me and saying, man, I was such a big fan of yours, and now you screwed these fighters over, and F you, and this. And I go, you never really were a big fan of me. I'm sorry. Because if you were a big fan of me, like, for instance, I love The Rock and Dwayne Johnson. And if somebody would say, oh, he screwed some fighters over, I'm not going to scream at Dwayne Johnson. I'm going to do my homework and figure out if these people were right or wrong, you know, because that's what a real fan does. And if they would have done the homework, they would have known, oh, no, shit, he got screwed too. He actually lost money too, you know. So those things, that was no fortunate thing. But if people just know that I'm just there, you know, if you're a friend of mine, I will never let you down. I will always pick up the phone. You know, my wife, I mean, I treat her like what? Like the Bible says, one flesh. I'm 27 years with her. I wish that people would come in our home one time just for a week and learn what we do, because apparently we found the way, man. There's no fighting in the house, never fighting in the house, no screaming in the house. Like, if I would raise my voice when I was when the kids were young, they would think there was a fight. Then I go, honey, I'm just saying, if I say, listen, can you, excuse me, can you listen? If I just would say that, they would think I'm afraid, I'm angry. And I go, why would they think that? Because they never hear that. We're, you know. And I think that people need to live like that, you know, give each other a little bit of space and having a good time. Just, you know, get the anger out, you know. And if a relationship doesn't work, work on it, because that's what you need to do. Don't divorce or don't just kick them to the curb. There was a moment that you fell in love with that person, you know. Let's see if we can rekindle that moment, you know. It takes some work. You know, we had our ups and downs, you know, but just, if you stay with them and go back to the time that you met each other the first time and you know, and just know that you're always there for each other. Yeah, of course you can scream, but, you know, and then suddenly it becomes so good that there's never any fight. I mean, I love it. My friends, I go, where can I find, do you have any sisters? Why can't I find one? You know, because they freaking love her, and I love her, and I love their friends. So I love that. I just want to be a decent person that people say, he was a good guy. You know, yeah, it was great. He was an ass kicker. He did some great acting too, and he did some great pro wrestling. But you know what? The best thing was, he was just a good dude. You know, you could always have a good time with him. That's what I want people to know.
28-4-1 career record. One of the greatest fighters of all time. One of the greatest commentators of all time as well. Boss, please give us some plugs and work. Everybody can reach you and maybe even see you either Facebook streaming or, you know, wherever you're kind of shooting those videos.
Yeah, so every morning at 10 a.m., except Sunday, but you want to watch Sunday because that my student, Dana, she's doing a recovery day, so she goes, she takes you through stretching and all that stuff. But for the rest, on Saturdays, it's Q&A. So if people want to ask me questions, whether it's technical questions, we're at a gym, so I can show you techniques as well, or just regular questions, that's on Saturday at 10 a.m. Every day it starts at 10 a.m. Pacific. And then Monday through Friday, we're just working out. So that's on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/BossRhythm. On YouTube, it's youtube.com/officialBossRhythm. And then on fight.tv, that's an app. You need to have it. But if you have it, you know, it's like a Netflix, but they're for fighting. Only fights. It's like a UFC pass also, like that. But then all different kind of fighting. I'm on there as well. It's all free. So check that out. Twitter, I'm not a lot on Twitter. I will check my Twitters, but, you know, I'm a little bit more on Instagram, and that means I don't react a lot anymore. I did this, I'm a very devout Catholic. I spent a lot of time on that. And I did this 90-day, they call it the Exodus 90 last year, in where for 90 days you have, I mean, there's not a lot you can do. You know, just they get 3 meals a day, nothing in between, no sweets, no sugars, no TV, no movies, no sports game, nothing. Everything is cut out, but only for your work you can use your telephone and your computer. And that's when I realized that we are wasting a lot of time on things that are really not that important. And after that, you know, my body starts feeling better, less injury, of less pain and inflammation because of all the sugars I cut out. So I start living like that more than I did for the same as I did for those 90 days. And that meant social media. I cut a lot of social media out. Yes, I do the streaming, but you won't see me posting a lot on Instagram and on Twitter. I don't do that anymore. I like to show techniques to people. That is something I still enjoy and people ask for, and then I'll do it. But for the rest, I'm, took a step back. It's not as important. I hope more people see this as well. And also the youth, you know, it's so important nowadays to have these likes and all that stuff. And if you don't have enough, you're not a cool guy. And I go, guys, it's so superficial, man. Please stop with it. Just be a good person.
Absolutely, boss. Quite an honor, quite a pleasure to get you on. One of the greatest of all time, no doubt about it. El Guapo himself, boss. Thank you so much for all the time you gave me here tonight.
You're very welcome, my friend. Thank you for the interview. I had a good time as well.
All right. Thank you so much, boss. You have yourself a great night. I really, really appreciate it. Quite the honor for me, so thank you very much.
All right, John. I appreciate it, bro.
Yep. You have a good one. Yep.
You, bye-bye. Bye.